This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. In the years leading up to America's involvement in World War II, Lisa Ocean writes, Iowa hardly seemed like a potentially enthusiastic or committed area for supporting the conflict against the Axis powers. After all, the state voted for Wendell Willkie in 1940, but after Pearl Harbor, things changed. Iowans realized that war was inevitable, and residents put their heart and soul into the conflict, and Iowa made a disproportionately larger sacrifice of its young soldiers than other states. Early in the North African front, hundreds of Iowa soldiers from several small towns in southwest Iowa were killed. Red Oak was especially hard hit. This hour, we'll talk to Ocean about her book, The Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 to 1945, From the Production Front to the Kitchen Front. We'll find out how Iowans sacrificed for the war effort. Talk of Iowa in 5 minutes following news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Dr. Lisa Ocean writes, and actually Dr. Ocean is quoting a journalist, Iowa is a piece of pie, at the potluck dinner given by the Ladies' Aid Society at Pleasant Hill Methodist Church. Dr. Lisa Ocean, I hope you're in Des Moines.
Yes.
And ready to go. You have, nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about your new book, Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 to 1945, published by the University of Missouri Press. It's divided into four sections, and they're all fronts: farm, production, community, and kitchen. Of course, kitchen is my favorite, I have to say right now. I love that quotation. I don't know who wrote it. Iowa is a piece of pie at the potluck dinner. You know, I don't think it's changed that much from World War II, at least in that regard. I don't know what you think.
No, in many ways, probably not. So, but I like that idea of using pie, too, as a symbol. And it wasn't apple pie during World War II, but blueberry pie. That was the symbol of home. So,
why blueberry pie?
I don't know. Ernie Pyle writes about that in all of his essays about the GIs and that. And I think maybe because it was hard to make, you know, in an Army situation. You certainly couldn't send it through the mail. So it was a very missed pie. I don't know. It just seemed to appear.
All right. Well, I thought that was interesting. I should mention Dr. Lisa Ocean is instructor and co-director of the Iowa Studies Center at Des Moines Area Community College in Des Moines. And this book is just out. It's really quite wonderful. If it takes you back to that period, and if you didn't live through it, I would recommend reading the book. And if you did live through it, read the book. My parents talked a lot about this time. I want to start with your preface. I hate to start with politics, but you say, though Iowa as a state cast its electoral votes for Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 and 1936, it turned away from the president in 1940 and 1944. In short, Iowa hardly seemed like a potentially enthusiastic or committed area for supporting this conflict against the Axis powers. There were a number of states, mostly in the upper Midwest, that were pretty isolationist, Dr. Ocean. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chicago was considered sort of the heart of the isolationist area. But what I was trying to show, too, is that isolationism was a more complex idea. It wasn't simply that we didn't want to get involved in this war. We were trying to avoid problems and that. But rather, there'd been a great deal of hurt from the Great War. Many men had been killed in that. The consequences, the economic consequences for rural Iowa after that were quite severe. And then with the Great Depression, people didn't think we could afford to be in a war. And so there was a lot of complex ideas in that with the isolationism. So that was sort of the point I was trying to make, you know, why look at Iowa and that. And how after Pearl Harbor and that, we became very enthusiastic soldiers of war on the home fronts.
Is it something about just sitting in the middle of the country that makes you maybe more isolationist? You're just so far away from
Well, there was some of that. You know, we felt rather protected, though it was interesting when there was that explosion at the Iowa Ordnance Plant just outside of Burlington, and that was on December 11th, 1941, so it was just a few days after Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. It had to be investigated for possible sabotage by the Japanese. So, there was a lot of fear in the air, even in Iowa. that time.
Yeah, we want to talk about that later. Amazingly large ordnance plant built early. Actually, the construction started before Pearl Harbor, didn't it?
Right. Both. Yeah. We had two ordnance plants, and that's always what I try to emphasize, is how much we were preparing before Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And that. So people tend to think everything starts after December 7th.
Why did we vote for Wendell Willkie in 1940?
There needs to be more written about that campaign. The 1940 campaign and the 48 campaign were very interesting. Mm-hmm. And that. So Wendell Willkie had, I don't know, there was sort of a lot of kind of promising, unique ideas. Iowa has been, still is, very Republican in that. So it was sort of turning back to its own pattern. So 40, and there were a lot of people angry in 40 about, Roosevelt running for a third term, even though Europe was at war, So, but it was interesting, though, in 48, Iowans voted for Truman. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's when they knew the polls were wrong. And
well, so. Anyway, the isolationists pretty much faded away with Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That pretty much did it for the isolationists, right?
Right, yeah, exactly, that day.
Dr. Lisa Oshien's new book is The Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 to 1945, just out from the University of Missouri Press. If you'd like to take part in our conversation, we'd love to have hear your comments or questions. You can call this toll-free number, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@uiowa.edu. Let's start with the farm front, chapter one. You write, Food for Freedom became the urgent patriotic agricultural campaign to develop and maintain all-out production, and Iowa's farmers, representing a leading agricultural state, played a significant role in this national battle. I was absolutely amazed at how quickly agricultural production changed in Iowa in the war years. We had lots of horses in 1939. Right.
So, now with the Depression years, and so there'd been, trying to scale back, through different AA government programs and that, and to trying to regulate markets so that Iowa farmers could survive. And then suddenly with the world at war, there was a desperate need for, Iowa's products and that. So there's a quick turn in 1940, 1941, again before Pearl Harbor, the need particularly for Iowa corn, hogs, chicken, eggs, milk, many of the standard products. And then later on, we would start to add soybeans and then even hemp production.
Well, I want to get to hemp.
That isn't what you think. No, I have to keep explaining that to my students.
we'll clarify that. But soybeans were not a big deal at all until the war started.
Right. Soybeans were really considered in the 1930s, a forage. You baled them up and you fed them to cattle and such. And then with the Japanese occupation of a number of islands, and that we lost sort of our oil supply, food oils. And that, and so suddenly, that was considered a patriotic thing to produce with soybeans. Right. It was a way to get back at the Japanese. So it seems funny to us now, with soybeans, the second largest crop in the state. But we really had to persuade farmers to do that in the 40s. It was something unique.
Yeah. Well, I want to get back to horses for a minute. You say in 1944, Iowa still claimed the title of leading horse state with 612,000 head, and 45% of Iowa farms remained entirely dependent on animal power. Now, that is absolutely amazing. But then John Deere came in pretty fast.
Right. Well, and the tractors had always been present. I mean, that had been since the Great War and that. But it was a matter of affording one and getting them more, like your news article beforehand with steel wheels and, things like that. Getting a tractor from field to field could be difficult, the cost of it and that. So when farmers could start to afford tractors in 1940, that's when, some of the production was the rationing and things afterwards. So it was difficult to afford a tractor. Mm-hmm. So after the war, that's where it really shoots up, the mechanization of Iowa's fields.
All right. Well, the war starts, and many of young men, and they were mostly men, weren't they? There were some. You don't break it down between men and women, but there were women enlisting too.
Right, we certainly had the WACs being trained here in Des Moines. So, I was very fascinated as I was looking through all the Des Moines Register articles. So that too is another area that needs to be explored more fully. In that, but there certainly were women in the WACs and the WAVES. And then as nurses, too. So a number of women were serving.
But the thing is, the state needed a lot of people to stay on the farm to ramp up production. And you say that actually Iowa's total war deaths in World War II, 42,081. During that same time, there were 40,000 farm accident fatalities. Right. That is unreal.
Mm-hmm.
But so who stayed on the farm?
Well, there was a farm deferment that was issued in 1943 in that. So you could, as the oldest son or the only son or that, you could gain a farm deferment in that. But there was a lot of stigma mm-hmm. to that for those young men. You know, they realized they might forever be looked at as someone who didn't serve their country during a time of need, though they were just as needed on the farms. For military reasons and that. So some stayed in that. So that was one. But the labor shortage was the biggest issue, you know. And there were lots of different groups tried in Iowa. Everything from, you know, Southerners were coming up. We had people from Jamaica and Mexico coming into the state to work. We particularly worked our own families. You know, the women and the children were even working longer hours and that. And even prisoners of war, both Algona and Clarinda, were utilized for farm labor.
And I suppose as tragic as it was, many of the fatalities on the farm were children, I'm assuming, right?
Some. A lot with, you know, farming and mining were the two most dangerous occupations at that time. And so if you're introducing new mechanization, if you're speeding up, you're working long hours, you know, sometimes 14, 16-hour days, and that, a lot of stress. I mean, you just add all of those elements together. It just creates for a more dangerous situation.
I suppose that early farm machinery probably was just a lot more dangerous than the current machinery, too, right?
Exactly. So.
Yeah. We want to talk about the POW camps. I had no idea, but we had a large prisoner of war camp in Algona, as you mentioned, and also in Clarinda.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the two big prisoner of war sites, costing about 3,000 prisoners, 500 military police. We'll get back to our discussion with Dr. Lisa Ocean. Her new book is Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 to 1945, published by the University of Missouri Press. We'll take your calls and emails at 866-780-9100 or talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org. Back in a minute. It's 20 minutes past 10. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese with Dr. Lisa Ocean, a co-director of the Iowa Studies Center at DMAC and an instructor. And her new book is The Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 to 1945, just out. Let's, Dr. Ocean, let's take a call. Dave has been waiting for a few minutes now. So let's go to Dave in Des Moines. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Dr. Ocean, I had heard that there were some female transfer pilots stationed in Moberly, Missouri, and I was wondering if there were any training facilities or bases or any female pilots training or working out of Iowa. Thanks. I'll take my answer off the air.
That I don't know. Like I said, I tried to focus on this book what Iowa citizens were doing in that. So I know certainly with the WAC National Training Base here in Des Moines, there were some other smaller ones in Cedar Falls, I believe. But I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. It's a good one.
Okay. Well, let's see if we can talk next to Kent, who's also calling from Des Moines. Good morning, Kent. Kent, you're on the air.
Hello. I want to speak briefly about the importance of meatpacking as part of this effort. You already mentioned Iowa as a major meat-producing state. I grew up in Ottumwa in the 60s when Morel's was at its zenith, moved to away in 1969. But in 1995, I was hired as an independent producer to work on a program produced by the Labor Institute for Public Affairs, AFL-CIO, called Working for Victory, How American Workers Helped Win the Second World War. And the segment that they hired me to produce was about Morel's in Ottumwa and a canned meat product called Kachanka that they produced for distribution in Eastern Europe, kind of like Spam.
Mm-hmm.
And also learned a lot about how women increasingly came into work in meatpacking plants, including the first time that women had ever worked on the cut-and-kill floor. Before the war, they had men's jobs, women's jobs, and boys' jobs. And during the war, many, many more women came in to work in the plant, and I actually interviewed a lot of the surviving workers in Ottumwa that were still living in Ottumwa in 1995 for that program. Did you see any evidence of other things like that or other kind of manufacturing efforts in Iowa that were part of the war effort?
Oh, yeah. Iowa did a lot of what were called subcontracts at the time. And so, like I tell my students, you know, we weren't in the big newsreels and that, but we were the necessary parts to all of that. And it was funny, too, on the meat processing. I expected to find all sorts of ads for Spam, and I only found two in all of the Iowa documents that I found. I think one was in the Sunday paper. But there were other canned meat products as well. We were also starting to dry eggs, and that we could then ship overseas. So that was another production effort as well. So, yeah, there's just a myriad of things going on in Iowa at this time.
Thank you so much, Kent.
I appreciate it. Looking to reading your book.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kent. 866-780-9100. As we get to the kitchen section, we'll be talking more about food and all of the homemakers being strongly urged to can everything in sight. The idea being to some more food could go overseas. The food in tin cans could go to the troops, and we'll get to that. Dr. Ocean, I know you wanted to. You mentioned maybe you might want to read a small section. I like to hear, it might be fun to hear you read. Do you have one selected?
I do.
Okay. Go for it.
Okay. This is titled Harold L. Smith. The immediate post-war period seemed one of peace, but also one of pain. The money spent on war bonds had been an investment. The scrap given in drives was never missed. But the boys who went to fight and their ultimate sacrifices shaped the immediate and lingering years of the post-war period. Both the soldier and his Main Street became symbols of the war. John Bloom, in V was for Victory, summarizes all that the soldier represented in this fighting effort of the good war. The hero of World War II stood for blueberry pie and blonde sweethearts, for the family farm and for Main Street, for perseverance and decency, for Americanism as a people's way of being. A war novel by Iowa author McCanley Cantor, titled Happy Land, became a Hollywood movie that portrayed the fighting effort in such terms when it described a small-town Iowa father's grief after his son's war death. The Time Movie Review described the story as a tender, folksy elegy for a typical American boy who was killed in the war, and for his typical American father, who is thereby killed in spirit. Still, the story's strong moral message remained strangely optimistic, stressing that the boy's brief, easygoing, generous small-town life was worth dying for because it was worth living. Though the emotion in the sentimental phrases may not seem authentic, the community front had truly sacrificed far too many soldiers. General Dwight D. Ike Eisenhower remained a general who always understood the value of his young men and their importance to the people back home. Eisenhower's first question whenever he met any group of soldiers was to ask, "Where are you from?" War historian Stephen Ambrose describes Eisenhower's beliefs and expressions as decidedly Main Street. The general undoubtedly had the common touch. In a letter to his wife, Mamie, Ike reflected on the sacrifices people back home were making for this war. Ike wrote, Mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, wives, and friends must have a difficult time preserving any comforting philosophy and retaining any belief in the eternal rightness of things. War demands real toughness of fiber, not only in the soldiers that must endure, but in the homes that must sacrifice. This war, like all wars, left behind so many deaths, along with the shattered lives of grieving loved ones. The death of one son, Harold L. Smith of Winterset, symbolized the many other young lives lost, and his family and his town portrayed all the families and communities that tried to cope with the aftermath of those deaths. Smith entered the service on March 25, 1944, a year after his graduation from Winterset High School as valedictorian, band letter winner, and basketball co-captain. His nickname was Smitty, the class prophecy called him Professor, and the yearbook described him as being as merry as the day is long. Smith received military orders to be sent overseas in October to England, then to Luxembourg, where he fought in General Patton's Third Army. During that excruciating winter in Europe, many teenagers, barely trained, were fighting on both the Allied and German sides during the Battle of the Bulge. Ambrose, in his combat history, Citizen Soldiers, comments that in the winter of 1945, America was throwing her finest young men at the Germans. On February 12, 1945, Smith died of wounds received in battle while leading a machine gun action against the enemy. The official letter to his mother, Harriet L. Smith, stated, "The War Department has informed me that your son, Technician 5th Grade Harold L. Smith, has given his life in the performance of his duty." He was 19 years old. The Smiths held a memorial service on Sunday, March 25, 1945. Another letter to his parents from his commanding officer, Captain Lamont Pinkston, told them, "The loss to our purpose of a man with such character, courage, and ability is great and will be felt for some time." The Iowa Legionnaire also expressed its condolences. "Comrade Smith and your brave wife, all Legionnaires mourn with you in the supreme sacrifice paid by your heroic son. There is little we can say or do at this hour to relieve your anguish, but God and country are thankful for the service of your son." Years later, Harold Smith's parents requested that his body be sent home. He was buried on August 31, 1948, in the Winterset Cemetery. Madison County residents installed their permanent memorial plaque in their courthouse hall on July 11, 1951, to replace the temporary wooden honor roll on the courthouse square. This memorial bears Harold Smith's name, along with the 1,500 other young men from this one Iowa county of 99 who served in the military during the Second World War. And the names of the man who made the supreme sacrifice are starred on the bronze plaque. A later memorial, dedicated in 1984, would also be composed in bronze, but across the world in Luxembourg. It too remembered those who served and sacrificed.
Dr. Ocean, we have to take a break. Dr. Lisa Ocean, reading from The Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 and 1945. We'll take a break for a few minutes. We'll take some more calls after the break as Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Today, talking to Dr. Lisa L. Ocean. She's an instructor and co-director of the Iowa Studies Center at DMAC and the author of a wonderful new book called The Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 to 1945. We'll take your calls at 866-780-9100. Dr. Ocean read a passage from the book just before the break, and I wanted to just go back to, we're still on the farm front. There's four fronts in the book. I hope we can get through all of them, but you write that the Des Moines Register conducted its own statewide Food for Victory campaign in which Mr. and Mrs. Harold Schultz of Schleswig won the first Merit Award for their outstanding farm family effort in production. This farm couple had solved their labor problems, as did thousands of other farm families by the wife's taking over the hired hands work, plus gathering over 100 eggs a day and canning 500 quarts over the summer. The amount of canning that went on was just absolutely mind-boggling. And it continued, didn't it, throughout the entire war of time?
Oh, it did. In 1943, American women canned 4.4 billion quart jars of food. And the average for some women was about 163 quarts. And when you're only doing seven at a time, you know, and, you know, in a hot water bath or a pressure cooker and that, in a hot kitchen, I mean, there's no air conditioning at the time. This is tremendous work.
That's right. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the kitchen front, which is the last chapter. Let's go first, though, to a call. And Greg has been waiting in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
Good. I was just wondering if the way Iowa reacted after Pearl Harbor is analogous to the way Iowa reacted after 9/11. And if there's any difference, is it atypical of the whole nation, and does it make our nation more vulnerable to attack from without or from within?
Well, the difference, we knew something was going on before Pearl Harbor and that. And so there had been a lot of talk, a lot of polls, you know. We knew we were being pulled into war. We knew there was going to be possibly some surprise attack. No one knew, though, where or when. So that was a difference in that. So, you know, it's hard to make the analogies. People try, but they're so very, very different, you know.
Yeah, I think it's really great that you're bringing out how Iowa and, it's, you know, probably the whole nation came together, and that's what really helped us succeed. And it's too bad we can't function that way all the time as fellow Americans working together to make things better for everybody on the face of the earth even.
Yeah. Well, people really felt, they were a part of World War II. You know, everything from the draft. Everybody knew somebody who was serving, and that if you look at the war bonds and the money people were contributing, the work that they were doing, all of that. I mean, it just surrounded their lives. Everything, you know, like I said, from war bonds to scrap drives to the draft and that. So,
thanks a lot for that call, Greg, from Cedar Rapids. Lines open 866-780-9100. Dr. Ocean, I want to jump ahead because we have an email, and this person is writing about the SS Red Oak, which was a World War II victory ship preserved as a museum ship in Richmond, California.
Mm-hmm.
The ship is now being restored in Richmond as a part of the Richmond Museum of History, and that's good to know. But that brings up the whole issue of Red Oak because this town was really hard hit, especially early in the war, as many young men volunteered to go to the African front. Red Oak tragically lost many, many of those soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it was Southwest Iowa. I mean, Red Oak stands out because it's one of the largest towns in that. But it used to be, you know, that you served in a unit. You served in a certain region. It was thought that you would already have a cohesiveness with the men and that. But, you know, it can have tragic results if you have too many men in units from one area. And so in North Africa, when everything was going wrong on that, there were so many that were killed or prisoners of war. So there's a very dramatic aerial photo of Red Oak in Life magazine. And then in that, you can see where all of the telegrams were sent. But towns like Villisca and Stanton, which is my dad's hometown, they were hit hard as well. So,
well, let's get back to, just to clarify all of them, not just Red Oak, a lot of
right,
towns.
Right, but
in Southwest Iowa.
Right.
Let's try to wrap up the farm front. You say when the war was nearly over, most of Iowa's farms had become quite prosperous, and the income for Iowa agriculture in 1945 was at its highest level ever. So the farmers were making some money, some serious money, through the war years.
And this would continue, you know, on into the 1950s and 60s and that. So farmers were very leery after the end of the war because we had had an economic plunge in 1920 after the Great War. And Iowa suffered even more than most Midwest agricultural states after the First World War. So people were kind of bracing themselves for that. But there had been a lot of pent-up savings, you know, and so there was a lot of investment. The world markets continued because Europe was so desperate for food, you know, through the 1950s even. So,
well, we have to get to hemp. In 1942, you're right, hemp was considered a weed growing in ditches and fence rows, but by the very next year it was listed as a war priority. Over 4,000 Iowa farmers devoted 45,000 acres to hemp in 1943. What was the hemp used for?
The hemp was used for like burlap and ropes, lots of materials where you need a rough fabric.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but that sort of faded away at some point.
Well, we didn't want it to. The problem was, like farmers in Kentucky and some other areas, we produced all the hemp that we needed for a number of years. And so the federal government was saying to turn away from that. But Iowa farmers liked hemp. It was a good row crop. It was mechanized. You know, it grew well in Iowa. We had some factories that were converting it.
Yeah.
So it was a good product all around.
Well, let's move on to the production front. Iowa's war production preparation starting as early as September 1939, when 72 manufacturing firms became ready to swing immediately into war production. Davenport, Dubuque, Burlington, Sioux City, Bettendorf, Waterloo. I guess Iowa was punished a bit by voting for Wendell Willkie, as some of the major plants were given to Missouri and other places, correct? But we still had our share. And then we had this amazing ordnance plant built in Burlington. Describe that, if you could, because it really is mind-boggling how big this thing was.
Oh, exactly. Well, the idea in World War II was to decentralize. So the idea was we should have more of these ordnance plants making the munitions for war in the Midwest and that. So we would have two during World War II. The first, the Iowa ordnance plant, the IOP, I can't even remember how many millions of dollars and acres. And, you know, it was just a tremendous manufacturing effort. You know, Iowans had never seen anything like it before. And so that plant produced really large bombs, like bathtub-sized bombs and that. It unfortunately wouldn't have a good safety record in, as I mentioned before, in December of 41. And then there was a terrific blast that could be heard 25 miles away that happened in March of 1942. So it was dangerous work and that. And then after the war, that plant would be only one of two in the nation to then convert to atomic bombs and doing that kind of production. So.
Okay. And, of course, the Burlington plant is still very much strong today. I'm not sure what they make there today, but at any rate, high security area. It was a high security, actually a surprisingly high security area in World War II. And then, as you mentioned, just a few days after Pearl Harbor, at the Burlington facility, just an unbelievable explosion.
Mm-hmm.
How many men were killed? Did you say?
If I remember correct, it was 13 on the first and 25 on the other. And I've made some talks around Iowa, and I've met two children of men who were killed in that blast. So.
Well, you just have a lot of, TNT being moved around.
Right.
It would just take anything to set some of it off, I suppose.
Right, exactly. This was very, very dangerous work. And the explosions happened when there were shifts, you know, taking place. So there were more people at the factory. But no sabotage. They had them both investigated.
Okay. And the other ordnance plant in Ankeny, you know, 219 buildings to complete the complex, 70 main manufacturing buildings, 3 administrative buildings, 30 magazines for powder storage.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war, this shut down, though.
Right. John Deere would buy in 1946 the main manufacturing area, and it continues to this day. A number of the other buildings would be torn down, and that land would sort of lay vacant. It was in 1966, then this is when DMAC starts on that land. So I always tell my students, where they're sitting was a machine gun bullet range, in the 40s. And you can still see when you drive into Ankeny Magazine Road, and they just tore down the last of those shacks there where they would test them. You had to have them spaced so far apart, so in case one blew up, it didn't take everyone with it. But that plant produced enough 50-millimeter machine gun bullets for every person on the planet. It had an incredible production record. And 60% women.
I was just going to ask you that. 60% women.
Right.
But you know, it's funny. All these all of these young men and women going off to the war fronts. Still, there were a lot of there was still a big need for employment in Iowa
right,
at the time, and
right.
People stood in line to get these.
Right. And that's why it was located in Ankeny, because there was still such a high unemployment rate. And that because of the coal mines that were being shut down and some other things, too. So Ankeny itself wasn't too thrilled to have the plant there. They didn't want to be a boom town, which is a little bit ironic now.
Yeah.
They kind of feared the consequences of growing too big too fast.
Dr. Lisa Ocean is an instructor and a co-director of the Iowa Studies Center at DMAC, her book, Home Fronts of Iowa. Dr. Ocean, you have this little note in the production section of the book, about a civil rights sit-down strike in 1948 at a segregated Des Moines business called the Katz Drugstore. I had never heard of this, but this did indeed happen in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have other details on this?
It's a very, very nice essay on it in the book Outside In, which has been out for some time, and that. But I kind of remind my students, too, they hear about the 1960 sit-in in the South, and that makes all the textbooks. But actually, we'd had a very successful sit-in of civil rights at that time. And there was also a challenge to employment at the ordnance plant in 1940. It was a black teenager. She was 18 years old, and she brought a suit against the federal ordnance plant for unfair hiring practices. So,
yeah. And then Maytag converting its manufacturing process from washing machines in Newton, of course, to defense production. I didn't realize that, but they totally shut down the washing machine manufacturing.
Right.
Which
only 3%. They could still manufacture parts. So in case your washing machine broke down during the war years, you could get it repaired.
Oh, okay.
But other than that, they could not produce washing machines. And they'd done well even during the Great Depression and that. But Maytag was extremely proud of its engineering record. They saved the federal government, I think it's almost $1 million, in their design efforts in what they were doing. So rather complex, but they were very, very proud of that. So.
And then you write, Iowa contributed to the atomic bomb in two ways. One Iowa connection was Paul Tibbetts from Glidden. I didn't realize he was an Iowan, who, of course, was the pilot of the Enola Gay, which dropped the first bomb on Japan. And the second connection was that at Iowa State College, now Iowa State University, 2 million pounds of high-purity uranium metal was formed into 2.25-inch cylinders, and given to the Manhattan Project. That's very interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, people don't realize with the Manhattan Project, it was actually very dispersed. So there were a number of research universities who were participating in a particular way, and that nobody quite knew what anybody else was doing because it was such a secret operation and that. But Iowa State College would win an E Award for their efforts that was given to manufacturing groups for excellence in that. So very proud of its record. And they would have an Atomic Research Institute in 1948-49 that was established there as well.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left and two fronts yet to go. So
okay.
Let's move on to the community front, the community efforts to help the war. Huge scrap metal drives to begin with. The National Jalopy Campaign, I guess, to scrap your old car for the metal. Waste paper drives, What else?
Oh, there were rubber drives in that. There was even women contributed their hose. That was one. Children had fond memories of the milkweed pod drives, I think mostly because they got out of school on a beautiful fall day and got to tramp around looking for milkweed pods. But the kapok in them was used for, or was supposed to be used for life preservers. You save tin cans. There was aluminum. Housewives were even encouraged to save, you know, teaspoon of fat each day, because that could be converted into explosives. So just everything. And it's interesting because it really was a very green movement, you know, in our modern day language of recycling, you know.
And the fat, I mean, they kept a teaspoon of the fat and put it in a coffee can or something.
Yeah, it was funny. My Aunt Mary, when she read the book, she that was the one thing she really remembered. She and Aunt Nell were in charge of taking that can down to the butcher, and then you got so many ration points for how much you contributed, and I think a penny a pound or something like that. Seems a little funny, but that also was needed. It's hard for us to imagine now how unprepared we were for what was needed in a massive world war, and we needed raw materials.
And then, of course, you mentioned rationing. Unreal how much stuff was rationed, including coffee.
Right, coffee was. Well, yeah, because of the shipping, sugar and coffee were rationed, not because we were short in the supply, but being able to get that shipped up, you know, to North America during times of war. So coffee, sugar was the first thing rationed. Coffee was for a while, and you really weren't supposed to have a second cup throughout the rest of the war years. And then canned goods, we had a very complicated ration point system. Even shoes were rationed, you know, so.
Well, it sounded really complicated. You say that rationing required continual rethinking and retraining. It was very complicated. 48 points allocated per month per person, including children. Individual point values were assigned to each food item. Very few packaged foods remained unrationed except olives, mincemeat, and popcorn. Two of those things I love. At least have all the olives you could possibly eat.
So, and that's why people were really encouraged. At first, they weren't encouraged to grow victory gardens. But later on, they were. And then if you could grow your own and then can it, that took some of the pressure off of the rationing. So people who were most hurt by rationing were those who lived in large urban areas.
And speaking of victory gardens, Iowans really came through big time. 4,000 men and women belong to the Federated Garden Clubs of Iowa, which you say in 1941 chose the motto, a forward-looking program for victory gardens. We had a ton of victory gardens every place in the state. Is that right?
But if you ask Iowans, you know, alive then, what they grew, they'll kind of shake their heads and they'll, well, that was a city term. You know, we just grew bigger gardens
Well, by 1944, you say approximately 476,680 of the 701,000 families in Iowa planted victory gardens. That is, of course, 65%, I'm just guessing. That is absolutely amazing that people would go out and so many people would take part in this huge, huge effort.
Well, and part of it, too, is gardening is a way to relieve stress. And there was a lot of – I was impressed at the group gardening efforts, you know, outside of the Iowa Ordnance Plant. There was an area there, and people would tend to plot, you know, next to each other. There were the Friley lots at Iowa State, and so professors were, tending a lot. So there were a number of vacant lots utilized in Des Moines, for example. So it really was the thing to do. And children especially. I think, you know, it's important to remember all the children's work during this time. You know, children were contributing to the bond drives. They were the ones most enthusiastic about the scrap drives. If it weren't for the children, some of those scrap drives would have fallen apart. And then the gardens, you know, all of that work. So,
yeah. And Dr. Ocean, as we're just about out of time, mm-hmm. once the war ended, it just seemed like really quickly things got back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
Really quickly. People stopped the Victory Gardens, and the rationing ended, and it was almost as if the whole thing hadn't happened in a way,
mm-hmm.
except of course for the terrible grief from
right.
the families. You talk about the Sullivan brothers and mm-hmm. many other families in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, we forget too, we'd had really 20 years of depression in Iowa since the Great War, and then World War II. And so, we'd had 25 years of real economic turmoil, and that people were tired. And so the idea of getting back to normalcy and, carrying on was just wonderful.
And we didn't have any food shortages in Iowa at all. I'm thinking of Great Britain that had rationing
mm-hmm,
that continued
exactly.
through about 1953,
yeah.
54.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to worry
mm-hmm.
about that, certainly.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you for
thank you.
The conversation. Wonderful book. It's called The Home Fronts of Iowa, 1939 to 1945, University of Missouri Press. And Dr. Lisa Ocean teaches at DMAC, Des Moines Area Community College, co-director of the Iowa Studies Center. She joined us from our studio in Des Moines. Thank you, Dr. Ocean. Really appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Our student producer today was Christoph Mai. We had help, technical assistance from John Pemble in Des Moines and Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music composed and performed by Dan Knight. I'm Dennis Reese, Talk of Iowa production of Iowa Public Radio News.